AM 950, the progressive voice of Minnesota. Welcome into FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Wednesday afternoon. Hope tonight I'll be seeing you out at Hamline University as Professor David Schultz and I, frequent guest on the program, are going to be holding our impeachment and politics forum over at Hamline. Doors open at 6 o'clock with the talk beginning at 7. We'll also have a Q&A session available as well. And most importantly, it is free to attend, so no cost at all. Hope to see you tonight over at Hamline University where you can meet David Schultz and me. So definitely looking forward to that. But right now, very happy to welcome to the program, well, the man you just heard on the airwaves less than 10 minutes ago. That's Tom Hartman, who, of course, is going to be at the Blue State Ball coming up on Sunday, February 23rd at Bauhaus Brew Labs in Minneapolis. VIP will be from noon until 1. Then we'll have general admission from 1 until 4 over at Bauhaus Brew Labs. Your chance to meet Tom and other special guests. And Tom joins us now on the program to talk about a new book he just wrote titled The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back. Hey, Tom, thanks so much for joining us on the program today.
Hey, Brett, it's great to be on your show. Thank you so much.
Yeah, absolutely. So what I really like is that you've kind of developed this series called The Hidden History, where, of course, your previous book was The Hidden History and talking about the guns and the Second Amendment, and it also looks like you have another book coming up in terms of the hidden history where you'll be talking about the Supreme Court. And what I really like about this series is that you go a little bit deeper than just the high school textbook version in terms of the history behind these different topics. So really happy that now you're writing one, of course, on the war on voting and, well, also some strategies for how we can get some of our votes back. So really happy you wrote that. But what inspired you to kind of write this series about the hidden history?
I have noticed for a number of years now that I myself have less and less time to read books that used to be that I'd buy a 200-400 page book and, mm-hmm. you know, over the course of a month, I'd be able to actually read the thing. I just don't have that ability any longer. And a large part of it is that screens, you know, are sucking up so much of our time. And you know, we're all busy and things. So for quite a while, I've wanted to do a series of small books, really accessible, really easily read books. You know, a typical, 300-400 page book is around 60, 70,000 words. These are 35,000 word books. So it's longer than a 1,000-word newspaper column or article on a website. You know, the op-eds I write are typically around 1,000 words. It's longer than that. These are 180, 190-page books, but they're also, and they're small format. They're like the old pocketbooks, like the old science fiction books from the 50s and 60s that are, you know, fit in a purse or fit in a coat pocket. And they're easy, you know, a fast read, but good, solid, dense, well-packed information and stories to draw people through them.
Can you?
And we started with the hidden history of the guns and the Second Amendment. Mm-hmm. Then the second book that came out last fall was The Supreme Court, The Betrayal of America. This is the third, The War on Voting, this spring. It's coming out in another week, and you can pre-order them now. And I'm pretty sure we're going to be giving them out with people who sign up for the Blue State Ball.
Yeah,
and then we've got one on the hidden history of monopoly and the destruction of the American middle class. That's going to be fall of this year. And the one I'm writing right now, which will be for next spring, a year from now, is the hidden history of oligarchy and the destruction of democracy in America.
I have no idea how you're able to pull that off. Just writing one book would be intimidating to me, but you're cranking these things out more than once a year. So,
yeah. 5 hours a day, 7 days a week. And if you just sit in front of your word processor and lay down a couple hundred words every single day, you'll write a book every 6 months anyway. That's what I've been doing.
Wow. Well, I'm really looking forward to some of these you have coming out in terms of especially the one you're talking about. Yeah, the destruction of the middle class and kind of the oligarchy that's been in place. So definitely look forward to that one. When it's coming out again, you said it was this fall or is it next summer, you were saying?
This fall is the one about monopoly, how big business destroyed the American
sure.
dream and lowered our standard of living. And then the one on the destruction of democracy, the oligarchy one, that's going to be spring of 2021.
Gotcha. Okay. And by the way, you can get a copy of course, the newest book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, if you do purchase a ticket to the Blue State Ball, either general admission or VIP. And you'll not only get a book, but it will be signed by Tom himself. So certainly a good deal and a reason to attend the Blue State Ball, which will sell out this year. So order those tickets sooner rather than later. So let's dive into your book a little bit here, Tom. Again, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, because originally, we've always been seen as kind of the beacon of democracy around the world. And when you really even look at the history of the country, even going back to the founding and when the Constitution was written, what a lot of people don't even realize is that even prior to the fact when we, of course, outlawed women and people of color from being able to vote and slaves was that, well, even back then, people were, or the states largely were able to restrict who could vote. And a lot of that broke down by land ownership. If you were a landowner, you were allowed to vote. If you didn't, you weren't allowed to vote. So there's certainly a lot of history there that I think people sometimes miss.
Yeah, interestingly, Andrew Jackson in the 1820s was the big champion for allowing people who did not own land to vote. And as a consequence of much of his populist rantings, a number of states that still had laws on the books that said that you had to own land in order to be eligible to vote, changed those laws. Those were all pretty much all gone by the end of the Civil War. But the real story, I think, is the more modern story about the story of the Republican Party. After the Nixon debacle, the Republican Party was in shambles. There were people speculating that the Republican Party wouldn't survive. In fact, it would go the way of the Whigs. Some new party would replace it, Libertarians or something. And they just, you know, they didn't know what to do. And then in 1976, when Jimmy Carter beat Gerry Ford, an incumbent president, although, you know, obviously he'd been appointed, but nonetheless, at that point, the Republican Party was just in despair. And coincidental with that, that year, 76, the Supreme Court, and I covered this in the previous book, The Hidden History of the Supreme Court and the Betrayal of America, the Supreme Court ruled for the first time in the history of the United States that if a billionaire owned a politician, gave an individual politician enough money to make it possible for them to get elected and continued to support them, and in exchange for that demanded from them particular policy votes and actions, that we used to call that bribery, we used to call that corruption, but in 1976, the Supreme Court, a 5-4 decision, a very contentious one, officially decided that, or officially ruled that, that in fact is First Amendment free speech, that using money for political purposes is not, that money wasn't money, that money was speech. And it was protected by the First Amendment.
This almost sounds like Citizens. This almost sounds like Citizens United before Citizens United, essentially.
That's exactly right. 2 years after that, in 1978, in a decision called Bilotti, First National Bank versus Bilotti, the Supreme Court ruled that this was also true of corporations. They could also own politicians. Then in 2010, the Supreme Court doubled down on this and Citizens United and actually expanded it and knocked down a few other laws, going back all the way back to 1907, the Tillman Act. 2013, with the McCutcheon decision, they ruled that there was not a limit to the number of politicians an individual billionaire or corporation could own. It used to be, I think it was 20, something like that, and they just blew that all up. And then with the McDonnell decision two or three years ago, the former governor of Virginia, who had taken over $170,000 in bribes and convicted of bribery, he was heading for prison, and the Supreme Court ruled, no, that wasn't bribery. That was free speech on the part of his donor. And in exchange for which Bob McDonald was recording infomercials for this guy's, you know, weight loss products. It was bizarre. But so that's where we're at. And so what happened was when in the 70s, in 76 and 78, when this happened, in 79, the Republican Party said, oh, gee, billionaires and corporations can buy politicians. Cool, because we don't stand for anything anymore. We've been shattered. We will take the money from the wealthy people. And at that point in time, the Democrats were, 80-90% funded by the labor unions. And so the Democrats were relatively unaffected by these decisions. But the Republican Party said, our hand is out officially, and that brought us Ronald Reagan. This just ocean of money, this river, flood of money that came into Washington, D.C. in 1980. And it's, you know, the Republican Party's been off to the races ever since. And then in 92, you know, after 12 years of this, they still had, you know, a fair amount of support in the United States. People hadn't figured out what kind of damage Reagan's economic policies were going to do to America. But they were starting to figure that out. Bill Clinton won in 92. And again, the Republican Party was facing an existential crisis. They really took it seriously in 96 when Bill Clinton got reelected. And that led to pulling out an old voter suppression trick that they had been using in the 60s in the Goldwater election in 64. In fact, William Rehnquist back in that election was standing in polling places in New Mexico, or in Arizona rather, Hispanic and Native American polling places and challenging voters. That's how he made his chops in the Republican Party. He ended up Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. And so in the election of 2000, Jeb Bush ordered his Secretary of State, Catherine Harris, to get a list of felons from Texas and compare that felon list from Texas to the voter list in Florida. And the felons in Texas, more than half of them were black, and the name pool for Asian Americans, Hispanic Americans, and African Americans is much smaller than the name pool for Caucasian Americans, because white Americans come from, you know, countries where they speak Greek and where they speak Spanish and where they speak French and where they speak German and where they speak, you know, all these different, you know, Slavic languages, all these different languages. So there's this huge variety of names, whereas African-Americans come from a relatively small slice of that demographic, who were the slaveholders in the South, mostly people from two countries in Europe, Ireland and England. And of course, Hispanic-Americans, their names are all derived from Spanish. So when you take a felon list that's mostly black and Hispanic and compare it to a voter list, and to say that these people must be voting, if they're on the both lists, they must be voting in both states, and they must be criminals, therefore, and so you knock them off the voting roll, you're going to disproportionately be knocking off people who are black and who are Hispanic. And that's exactly what happened. Jeb Bush, the governor of Florida in 2000, knocked some 90,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls, which got his brother within a few hundred votes of beating Al Gore in Florida. We later learned, of course, that his brother didn't actually beat Al Gore, but that's a whole other story.
Well, at least got him close enough where, yeah, they could have a court overturn it, right?
Well, actually, a year later, the New York Times, the Washington Post, and Gannett, and the Associated Press, they got all those ballots and took them in a 16-wheeler up to New York and spent a whole year counting them. And in November, I think it was November 17th, 2001, the New York Times published a long article that basically said, it was buried in the 17th paragraph because we'd just been hit on 9/11 8 weeks earlier. They published this long article, as did the Washington Post, and it's in my book, the excerpts from it, saying that when we actually counted the ballots, it turns out if the Supreme Court had not stopped the recount in Florida, Al Gore would be president. That by any measure, overvote, undervote, hanging Chad, pimpled Chad, dimpled Chad, intent of the voter, not intent of the voter, by any measure, Al Gore won Florida in 2000. But at that point, you know, they didn't want to say that. They didn't want to broadcast that loudly, so they kind of buried the story because they didn't want to diminish George Bush's credibility in a time of national crisis. So anyhow, they then, in the 2000s, going into the 2000s, they just doubled down on this, you know, using this technique of comparing felon lists with voters, or and then they got even simpler. Let's just compare the voters in Ohio with the voters in Virginia, or, you know, wherever, right? Pick two states. And again, what you'll find is that those populations that have a relatively small name pool will have large amounts of overlap, and that population that doesn't have a small name pool, which is white people, will not have a lot of overlap. And this is the technique that Chris Kobach pioneered. It's called interstate cross-check, where you just start comparing, you know, states to each other. And anybody who shows up, you know, John Johnson in Missouri, and there's a John Johnson in Ohio, let's strike them both off the voting rolls, because obviously it's somebody who's voting in both states illegally. And that's how, you know, just before the 2016 election in Wisconsin, Scott Walker struck almost 200,000 people off the voting rolls. Rick Snyder in Michigan struck over 200,000 people off the voting rolls. John Kasich in Ohio, over 200,000 people off the voting rolls. I mean, Pennsylvania, over 150,000 people off the voting rolls, and in each one of those states, Donald Trump won by fewer than 20,000 votes. So it's been a very effective strategy for the party, and it is the core of their electoral strategy. They know that people are on to them. Everybody has figured out they're just shills for the rich, powerful, and corporate, and they don't have majority support in the United States. So what they've got to do is make it easier for wealthy white people to vote and make it much, much harder for low-income people, students, older people, and people of color to vote. And they're doing it very successfully, very effectively all over the country.
And the strategies keep getting more and more sophisticated, like what we're seeing in Wisconsin, where essentially they're saying, well, if you don't respond to this form saying that, yes, you still live in your current location, well, then you're knocked off the voter rolls. We're seeing this happen in Ohio as well. Arizona, I know a while back, banned what was called ballot harvesting, where you would get ballots collected by mail by third parties, although it looks like a federal court actually overturned that. Do any of these efforts concern you more than others, or what do we need to do to fight back against some of these?
We need a federal constitutional amendment that says that we have a right to vote. I mean, Rehnquist and Bush v. Gore famously said, and I quote, there is no constitutional right to vote for president of the United States, period, full stop, you know, in the Constitution. There's no right to vote. And we need to establish a right to vote. We can do it at law. This is what H.R. 1 does that the Democrats passed, but it would have even more impact if it was in the Constitution. We also need to outlaw this voter caging, sending out the postcard and saying, if you don't send this postcard back, right, you're going to get knocked off the ballot. Back in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, the Republican Party used to do this, and they would mail them specifically into black neighborhoods or, you know, college towns. They operated under a court order. It was called caging, voter caging. They operated under court order for over 20 years that forbid this. And then when Ohio was doing this 4 or 5 years ago, a bunch of people sued them, a bunch of progressive activists. It went to the Supreme Court, and the 5-4 decision, John Roberts and his merry band concluded that, oh, it's just fine what Ohio is doing. And so now this is being done in every Republican-controlled state in the union as we speak. And this is the biggest challenge people are going to face. And you combine it with the fact that the 2002 Help America Vote Act created these placebo ballots called provisional ballots. If you've been knocked off the voting rolls, you can still vote, but you're given a provisional ballot. Provisional ballots are never counted unless the election is contested. And so you're literally, I mean, like in 2004 in Ohio, Al Gore lost by about 160,000 votes. There were 180,000 provisional ballots that were never opened, literally never even opened, much less counted. And so people think they voted. This is why the exit polls show that Democrats are winning all over the country. It's why the exit polls showed Hillary Clinton winning huge in Wisconsin, Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, Pennsylvania, and even Virginia, North Carolina, and Florida. The exit polls all showed Hillary Clinton winning. And yet in every single one of those states, the actual tabulated ballots showed that it was Donald Trump winning. The reason why, because people voted on a provisional ballot, didn't realize it would never be counted, walked out of the ballot place and said to the exit pollster, yeah, I just voted for Hillary Clinton. So that's what's going on, and that's what we need to wake up to and do something about.
You're listening to FYI Politics with Brett Johnson, as we are currently speaking with Tom Hartman, the author of The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back. And you can find lots more information about what we've been talking about, of course, in Tom's new book. And you can find that book wherever books are sold, including, of course, Next Chapter Booksellers right in St. Paul and lots of other outlets, too. Hey, Tom, thanks so much for joining us on the program, and really look forward to seeing you coming up on February 23rd for the Blue State Ball.
Thanks, Brett. I'm looking forward to seeing you again, too, and thanks so much for having me on your program. It's been an honor and a pleasure.
Absolutely. Again, and make sure you order that book, The Hidden History of the War on Voting, Who Stole Your Vote and How to Get It Back, or a great way to get that book, well, just order a ticket to the Blue State Ball, and you'll even get a signed copy from Tom. Order those tickets now over at am950radio.com. We'll take a break and come on back with FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Music. It's winter, it's cold, and you probably don't want to be outside. So cozy up inside with a new book from Next Chapter Booksellers, or get something to read on your next vacation. Next Chapter Booksellers is the largest independent, locally owned bookstore in St. Paul, with a full range of books and subjects. Stop in and the friendly staff will help you find the perfect book. Located on Grand and Snelling in St. Paul and at nextchapterbooksellers.com.
Anytime is the right time to update your music collection, so stop in at the Electric Fetus and browse their massive selection. You'll find everything from rock and pop to international and roots, and so much more on CD and vinyl. Not only is Electric Fetus the best stop for music, but they also carry a wide and unique range of gifts. Bath products, clothing, books, stationery, candles, incense, you name it. That's the Electric Fetus at 2000 4th Avenue South in Minneapolis and online at efetus.com.
Visit the wine bar at Cafe Latte and enjoy a unique handcrafted pizza and glass of wine, the perfect place for an intimate night or an evening with friends. Choices range from spicy Italian sausage and sweet roasted peppers to the one-of-a-kind nacho chicken pizza layered with blue corn tortilla chips. The approachable wine list offers over 30 by the glass, with special emphasis on wines from Washington State. End your night with one of Cafe Latte's melt-in-your-mouth desserts, 850 Grand Avenue, St. Paul.
Tom Hartman here telling you that solar energy isn't just for environmentalists. Switching to all energy solar is actually perfect for reducing your carbon footprint while also saving money on your monthly electric bill. The fact that solar panels cause no earth-harming emissions while it's producing energy is a bonus. Who in the world could object to that? But they can also help you save money month after month for decades. And they do it with a clean footprint. So go green and start saving money today by visiting allenergysolar.com.
This is Chad, owner of AM950. Our station has worked with Barbara from WYSIWYG Web Design for years on everything from logo to print design, and especially for developing our website. She does great work and is great to work with, listening to what our goals and design ideas were while offering new, innovative ideas to create the website we are proud of today. Barbara made sure she understood our station, our goals, and our mission before she started working on our site, and made suggestions to help control the cost. Plus, she's friendly, which set us at ease. I recommend Barbara at WYSIWYG Web Design because I know she will deliver an attractive, professional website within the budget you have. She is a local independent business that specializes in helping other local businesses achieve their website and design goals. She can work with nearly any budget and create anything from simple sites to robust custom functionality. To find out more about the company AM950 Trust, go to WYSIWYGWebDesign.com. Spelled out just like it sounds, WYSIWYGWebDesign.com.
Back on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson on a Wednesday afternoon. Eric, you and I were talking about during the break. Tom literally said, I just spend 5 hours in front of the computer each day and I write my books.
7 days a week. It's that easy.
Wow, what an insanely talented guy to be able to do that. That just sounds so intimidating to me to say, all right, I'm going to sit in front of a computer for 5 hours and I'm just going to type. It would be so tempting just to go, I'll type this, but let's go watch this YouTube video. Yeah, maybe we'll go on Netflix and I'll watch a show. Then I'll write my book. But
I'd have to disconnect from the internet.
I don't know.
I could maintain 5 hours of focus.
But even if you disconnected from the internet, I feel like I would just sit there with a blank look and then just saying, I'm just going to hit the letter A for a while, have an then go with the E.
I guess, you just have to build up some sort of tolerance, rhythm, pattern of behavior.
I mean, credit to Tom because his books are excellent as well. It's not like he's just going in there and writing a book because he has to. He puts a lot of time into these as well. So, big credit to him. That is absolutely insane that he's able to pull that off. And he is certainly a much more talented individual than
I know
when it comes to that
to
department.
A researcher on ADHD, so maybe this comes into effect. Maybe he's got some tricks.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, he might because, that is big credit to him, though. That is incredible stuff. All right, a couple of news stories before we head to our break. And this one is coming out of a GOP luncheon that took place this morning. Does anything good ever come out of a political luncheon that involves senators and House of Representatives members?
No.
I don't think anything ever good comes out of a luncheon. Whenever you hear a political party or a group of politicians are having a luncheon, bad stuff always happens.
Yeah, I don't know. At best, it's just completely worthless.
Yeah. Well, this one was not apparently this Republican luncheon they had this morning with a number of Republican senators, because the word is around D.C. is that apparently the Republicans actually have the votes now to block any witnesses from appearing in the Senate impeachment trial. And I have a little bit of a different take on this. I think this is actually great news, because you have to look at it from a certain lens. Even if you allow witnesses at this trial, he's still going to overall get acquitted. So I think it's a better political strategy to have no witnesses whatsoever, so then you can go back to Susan Collins and Cory Gardner, who, by the way, earlier today already announced that he will be voting against any witnesses. Put political pressure on them. And Joni Ernst, and who's the guy in North Carolina, Tom Tillis. That, to me, seems like a much more political advantageous type thing to have happen, where you have no witnesses. It gives you a great political argument where you can go and ask all of these vulnerable Republican senators, well, look at all of this subsequent information that has come out, and information you even knew at the time of the Senate trial, and yet you guys voted against having any witnesses whatsoever. Whereas if they do actually bring in Bolton and a few other folks, well, then you can have Joni Ernst and Susan Collins and Cory Gardner say, oh, well, we gave them all a fair hearing. We brought in some witnesses, and I still didn't see enough information to vote convict. I think it's much more damaging not to have any witnesses. So even though on the surface, yeah, it would be bad news not to have any witnesses at the Senate impeachment trial, and if we actually did have an impartial jury, then yeah, it would be horrible news not to have any witnesses. But we don't live in that type of environment right now. We live in a hyper-partisan environment where we already have jurors, i.e. senators, who have already made up their minds. So we might as well just turn this into as much of a sham as it can be, and that's exactly what you're doing by denying witnesses. So I, at least Eric, think it's great news that there are going to be no witnesses, because I think that is much more politically advantageous to people who oppose Donald Trump.
Yeah, at this point, I don't know. I'm bored by it all. Yeah. But it just seems like there's no winning or losing.
You just
at this
want
point.
Hunter Biden out there.
Yeah, I just want to be entertained by Hunter Biden. But everyone's kind of made up their mind.
Exactly. Mm-hmm.
There are not even arguing the same points, you know? Mm-hmm. Trump's side is arguing, oh, well, Biden's a bad guy. He's actually is corrupt. And it's like, that's not what this is even about.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. Everyone's arguing past each other, mm-hmm. and it's all, I can't imagine it amounts to anything. So I guess maybe you're right. Maybe at least we have some ammunition later.
Yeah, we'll just make it look like a sham. Give the appearance so you can put some of the vulnerable Republican senators in a tough position, because ultimately, no matter what happens with the presidency, even if you get a President Joe Biden or a President Bernie Sanders, if that Republican-controlled Senate remains, well, pretty much all of their agenda is going to be derailed come January of 2021, because our old buddy Mitch McConnell already said he's going to be the Grim Reaper. So, yeah, that's a guarantee to happen, even if you have a Democratic president. If that Senate is still controlled by Republicans, still going to be bad news. So another reason why, put as much pressure as you can on Republican senators, if that's your prerogative, trying to get more Democrats elected. We're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. So coming up next, I want to talk about Amy Klobuchar, because she was in the news yesterday when the AP released some information about this investigation they did into a man who was actually convicted of murder back in 2002 when he was only 16 years old. Apparently, there's some really flimsy information and ways that the investigation was conducted back in 2002. And I want to go in a little bit of a different direction with this, not talking about whether the methods Amy Klobuchar used were right and wrong back then. It's what I'm going to pose is a much larger question about the criminal justice system overall. So we're going to talk about that coming up next. But first, let's get to the 2020 Talks from Public News Service.
Welcome to 2020 Talks, where we track the 2020 election process from the studios of KHOI in the heart of Iowa.
Palestinians deserve human rights, freedom, justice, and equality, just like everyone else does. We want firm commitments from candidates that they're going to cut U.S. military funding for the Israeli military because of the human rights violations that they've been mired in.
Egyptian-Palestinian student activist Mo El-Sherbini is with Jewish Voice for Peace Action. He says Democratic candidates often avoid discussing the Israeli-Palestinian conflict. Yesterday, President Donald Trump weighed in.
Together, we can bring about a new dawn in the Middle East.
The president unveiled a new so-called conditional two-state solution with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu at his side, just hours after the prime minister was indicted in Jerusalem on three separate corruption charges. President Trump says he'll address what he calls, quote, the most difficult challenge of all, unquote, forging peace between Israelis and Palestinians.
I was not elected to do small things or shy away from big problems.
The initiative was widely reported to be without input or approval from Palestinian leaders as relations were cut off after Trump moved the U.S. embassy to Jerusalem.
President Trump has made it clear that he has absolutely no interest whatsoever in working toward equality for all, for Palestinians and Israelis. He is completely and totally supporting Prime Minister Netanyahu's agenda.
Beth Miller, also with Jewish Voice for Peace Action. Netanyahu's fighting to remain in office. Former Southland Mayor Pete Buttigieg suggests Trump's support has a cynical component.
He has infused domestic politics, making U.S. foreign policy choices in order to effectively interfere in Israeli domestic politics, acting as though that somehow makes him pro-Israel and pro-Jewish.
Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg, the two Jewish candidates in the Democratic primary, differ on what support for Israel means. Sanders says he believes Israel has the right to exist in peace and security, but also that
what U.S. foreign policy must be about is not just being pro-Israel. We must be pro-Palestinian as well. Right now in Israel, we have leadership under Netanyahu, who has recently, as you know, been indicted for bribery, who in my view is a racist. What we need is a level playing field in terms of the Middle East.
And responding to yesterday's announcement, Sanders said Trump's plan, quote, would only perpetuate the conflict, unquote. Bloomberg hasn't responded to Trump's peace plan. Last weekend, launching an effort he calls Unity for Mike, specifically aimed at attracting Jewish voters, he said his support for Israel was unconditional.
As president, I will always have Israel's back. I will never impose conditions on our military aid, including missile defense, no matter who is prime minister.
From Pacifica Network and Public News Service, I'm Lily Bolke. Thanks for listening at pacificanetwork.org and publicnewsservice.org.
And now taking a look at your weather, brought to you by Crooner's Lounge and Supper Club. Clouds are going to remain, at least for the rest of the week, as we're looking for a high of 25 today. Tonight, more clouds with a low around 13. Thursday could have a little bit of fog in the morning, but as you guessed, more clouds and a high near 27. Friday, a small chance for some snow with a high near 33. But Saturday, they are saying we might see a little bit of sun and a high near 37. Crooner's Lounge and Supper Club, the Eat Local Minnesota restaurant of the week. Lots of great music coming up, including the Sam Miltich Quartet playing tomorrow. Also, Pat Donahue will be there Friday. You might remember him from A Prairie Home Companion. And they got some Sinatra classics also on Friday. So check that out. Crooner's Lounge and Supper Club, croonersloungemn.com. Located off Moore Lake and Highway 65. We'll be back with FYI Politics up next.
Turn to Auto Technical with your vehicle donation. We have families waiting for a car. You know, over 85% of unemployed are successful in finding and keeping a job if they have dependable transportation. A car plus a job equals a life changed. 612-919-5526. We have families waiting for a car. 919-5526 or autotech.org.
Hi, I'm Scott Peterson with the Minnesota News Network, inviting you to join us for Minnesota Matters, a weekly program covering everything that matters in the North Star State. This week, the latest in local politics. So far, nearly 10,000 Minnesotans have violated the new hands-free law, a primer on the St. Paul Winter Carnival, and a Detroit Lakes author has a new book out chronicling decades of disappointments in Minnesota sports. Tune us in right here or at MinnesotaNewsNetwork.com.
Sunday mornings at 6:30 on AM 950.
You know how it is with vacuum cleaners. You buy them, you break them, then you throw them away, right? Well, not necessarily. Often, fixing your vacuum can be cheaper than replacing it. Ever heard of A1 Vacuum in Roseville? They offer free estimates. So if you wish your vacuum worked like new again, drop by. A1 Vacuum is ready to help clean up your vacuum cleaner act. Find us at a-1vacuum.com or call 651-222-6316.
FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. catch my show every weekday from 2 until 3 p.m. on AM 950. And Democracy Now, still be able to hear that every weekday now from 4 until 5 p.m. Also want to remind you tonight to check out my forum I'll be having with David Schultz regarding impeachment and politics over at Hamline University in St. Paul. It will be at Anderson Room 305. That's Anderson Room 305 at Hamline University. Doors open at 6 with the talk beginning at 7. And most importantly, it is free. No cost to attend whatsoever. Find more details over at am950radio.com. So I want to talk about Amy Klobuchar now, because you may have seen this in the news yesterday, where she's come under a little bit of fire after this AP investigation into a murder conviction of a teenager back in the early 2000s. So once we're done kind of reading through some of the details of the story, I'm going to take a little bit of a different angle on this case, because I think there is something that's actually missing that's an important point to make. But first, let's go through some of the details. A case against Amy Klobuchar, prosecuted almost two decades ago, is coming under fire after an Associated Press investigation. So Mayan Burwell was a 16-year-old back in 2002, and he was convicted for firing a stray shot that killed 11-year-old Taisha Edwards as she was doing her homework at a dining room table in Minneapolis. You might remember the story from back in the early 2000s, where it was on the front page of all the newspapers and also getting a lot of coverage on the local TV stations. But during an investigation, the Associated Press looked at over thousands of pages of police records, court transcripts, interrogation tapes, and interviewed dozens of inmates, witnesses, family members, former gang members, lawyers, and criminal justice experts. So they did a really thorough investigation in terms of what actually happened when Burrell was sent to prison. The outlet found that the police and prosecution leaned heavily on a teen rival of Burrell's who gave conflicting accounts when identifying the shooter. There was also no murder weapon found, no fingerprints or DNA evidence, and the police did not check alibis, according to the AP. One of Burrell's co-defendants, Ike Tyson, who was 21 years old at the time, admitted in an interview with the AP to being the trigger man in the fatal shooting. So Ike Tyson actually admitted later on that he was the guy, and not Burrell, that actually shot Taisha Edwards. He also recounted the crime, saying Burrell was not even present at the crime scene whatsoever. Burrell actually insisted to the police that he wasn't even at the crime scene, but actually at a nearby grocery store, Cub Foods, to pick up snacks with two friends. And interestingly, police never followed up, but the friends that he was with, Latosha Evans and also Donnell Jones, confirmed Burrell's alibi to the Associated Press and surveillance tapes from Cub Foods, which could have cleared Burrell's name, were never obtained by the police, according to the AP. So, as you can see, this investigation uncovered, well, a lot of problems with what Klobuchar's office had when she was serving as the Hennepin County attorney when they were trying to prosecute Burrell. Now, the reason why I'm bringing this up is not an attack on Amy Klobuchar saying, oh, well, look at how bad of a job she did when she was the Hennepin County attorney. Because, let's be honest, if any of the other Democratic candidates were in Amy Klobuchar's position back in 2002, if they, in some sort of parallel universe, were also serving as the Hennepin County attorney, guess what? They would have reached the exact same conclusion, or probably conducted a similar investigation as Amy Klobuchar. Because, as I brought up, this was a big story in the news in the Twin Cities back in 2002, and there was a lot of pressure on the county attorney's office and also the police to make sure someone was punished for shooting an innocent 11-year-old girl who was just sitting in her home in Minneapolis and doing homework and all of a sudden was hit by a stray bullet. So there was lots of public pressure to make sure someone actually got prosecuted and convicted and sent to prison. So I think the problem we run into right here is the fact that why do we even have people who are district attorneys or county attorneys or judges? Why are they even elected officials in the first place? That, I think, is the main issue I want to talk about. That strikes me as being something that can go down such a bad road is what we saw right here with Amy Klobuchar, because if she ended up saying, well, we don't have enough evidence to convict anyone back in 2002, imagine the amount of public outcry that would have ensued she probably would have had a good chance of actually losing her next reelection campaign to be the Hennepin County attorney. So I think that's the larger issue right there, is that when you have people who are part of the criminal justice system that are actually elected officials that can face reelection and have to run for office, I think that's problem number one right there, because no one who serves in that type of position ever wants to be perceived as being, well, quote, not tough on crime, unquote. You remember how tough in crime was a big thing back in the 90s and even into the 2000s. So that, I think, is the overall problem, is the fact that the entire criminal justice system is kind of, I wouldn't necessarily say corrupted, but it's not in a good place when you have judges and you have attorneys who are, well, at the behest of, well, the population that can either elect them or decide not to reelect them or even recall certain judges. I mean, even go back to the Brock Turner case. He was the guy that raped someone back at Stanford University a few years ago. And the judge in that case said, well, we're just going to put you on probation because you're a rich white guy. Obviously, that led to all sorts of a public outcry. And this judge ultimately was recalled, because he was perceived as not being tough on crime. Now, of course, the judge was probably wrong with the way he ruled, but that still puts elected officials that have that are affiliated with the criminal justice position, I think, in a really tough situation, where if you have to face voters year after year after year, that might influence the way you actually rule on certain cases. So I don't know necessarily what the solution might be. I mean, one idea would possibly be is having people like district attorneys or county attorneys, depending on where you live around the country, or judges. Maybe you have them all appointed by the governor or the president or some other elected official. Now, granted, of course, that doesn't completely remove the possibility that someone ruling on a case might have political leanings in terms of the fact that they want to make sure they are still maintained in their position. That would remove them at least one layer by having them be appointed. But overall, I'm just very disturbed by the fact that we still have this type of system here, not just in Minnesota, but around the entire country, where we have judges and prosecutors and district attorneys that are still elected by the people, because I don't think you can have that type of situation where politics could possibly play a role in terms of how someone rules. And like I said, this is not an attack on Amy Klobuchar. I mean, if you look at any of the other Democratic presidents, or Democratic candidates for president, like I said, they would probably have done something similar to Amy Klobuchar, because back in 2002, yes, she was under heavy pressure to actually make sure someone went to prison. So overall, we need some sort of different system, I think, to take the political aspect out of how prosecutors determine who they're going to try to put in jail, or in terms of how judges will rule on a case. I think another solution could possibly be maybe just having fixed terms where they never face re-election. Like, for instance, you just give a judge a fixed 10-year term, and when you're done, well, you're just done being a judge. And I think there should also be some sort of feature in there where if you serve at a judge at any level, you should no longer be able to hold elected office, whether that's the state legislature or the governor or, heck, even the city council. You can't be an elected official for X amount of years, or maybe even permanently, because as we saw with this case of Mayon Burrell, I think you absolutely ran into a situation where you had a district attorney's office that was eager to make sure someone went to jail, as the AP certainly uncovered right here. And I think part of the problem is the fact that you have judges and attorneys who face public pressure to actually be tough on crime due to the fact that they actually do have to face voters every so often. So we're at 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205, if you have any thoughts on that. But like I was saying, that's not a specific attack on Amy Klobuchar. That's more an attack on the criminal justice system overall, where I don't think you can have judges and prosecutors who actually face election.
My one comment would be, why do you feel that someone working within the system would be less bloodthirsty or less inclined to be harsh on crime like this?
Well, because
they still would be incentivized to try to go after crime as much as possible?
I think they still absolutely would be, but you would at least take the political aspect out of that with where if you have someone who is a district attorney that is facing a tough election, maybe 1 or 2 years from a certain point, and all of a sudden they have a high-profile case come before them, I think, yeah, you probably do have some public pressure on you to actually make sure you get a conviction. And I think, Eric, you're absolutely right in saying, yeah, that won't necessarily take away all of the bias. Certainly, you're always going to have judges and prosecutors that have a certain amount of bias, but I think at least taking the political aspect off the table would go a long way towards helping at least of getting more impartial rulings. So 952-946-6205, 952-946-6205. We'll come on back, take your calls, and go through a few more stories before we wrap on up here on FYI Politics with Brett Johnson.
Hi, I'm Peter Solak.
And I'm Adam Ostrowski.
We are here at Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces to talk about outdoor fires. Sitting around a fire is the oldest, most basic form of human activity.
What's new is in the way fire is burned. We can show you how to burn cleaner with a lot less smoke.
The radiant heat and light from an open fire is unmatched. It kindles our spirits and connects us to the outdoors. And now it's easier to experience and enjoy.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces sells and installs wood and gas burning fire pits and fireplaces. Let us help you experience an outdoor fire without all the smoke.
Come see the many ways you can enjoy a fire outdoors.
Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces has over 35 working wood and gas units on display at the corner of East Franklin and Riverside Avenue in Minneapolis. More information at woodlandstoves.com. Find the fire that works for you. Woodland Stoves and Fireplaces, out of the ordinary products and services since 1977.
FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Catch my program every weekday from 2 until 3 o'clock, and then Democracy Now! Will be at 4. No change to the Matt McNeil Show. His show remains weekdays at 3 p.m. on AM 950. So, want to say, send some good vibes and prayers to Governor Tim Walz, because he's going through a little bit of an ordeal today, which I'll tell you about in just a few minutes. A little bit more of a humorous idea. Ordeal, nothing really serious, but tell you more about that in just a couple of seconds. But first, let's talk to our buddy Randy in St. Cloud, who disagrees with me. So, Randy, go ahead.
Okay. Well, a couple of points. First off, on the Amy Klobuchar thing, and you contend that any of the Democratic contenders for president would probably have done the same thing.
Yeah, in some sort of parallel universe. Yeah, they also would have faced that same amount of pressure to put someone in jail.
They would have definitely faced the same amount of pressure, but would they have done the same thing that Amy decided to do?
I think there's a good chance. Several of them, yes.
Oh, several of them, yeah. Kamala Harris, I think, absolutely. Buttigieg, probably.
Oh, I think I know where you're going with this, Randy, but go ahead.
Well, yeah. Look at the record.
Mm-hmm.
Who got arrested in the 70s for when they were protesting housing rules in Chicago? Bernie Sanders, who marched with Martin. Bernie Sanders has been principled for a very long time, and what people seem to I wanted to use the wrong word, complain about is that, well, he just keeps saying the same old thing. Yeah, it's called being consistent. Which I don't think is a bad thing. I think it would be really nice if more of the contenders were consistent. Joe Biden. and I think on the point about not having any witnesses at the impeachment trial, I agree with you, given where we're at right now.
If we actually had an impartial Senate, then for sure you would want witnesses. But for the most part, we already know how about 45 or so of the Republicans are going to vote on that.
And so I agree with not having witnesses, given where we're at, might be the best political advantage for the Democrats.
Right.
Mm-hmm. However, the weak sauce that precipitated the whole thing was that grand political mastermind and eight-level chess player Nancy Pelosi, that we are not going to look at anything else. We're going to keep it just to this. Was like one of the I'm trying to...
Needless to say, you disagreed with her idea of just limiting an impeachment to those two articles.
This guy's been against our Constitution from the get-go. The Saudis have been renting almost two full floors of Trump Tower in Washington, D.C. at, it's like $300,000 a month. Yeah, and just all of this stuff, and we're going to hold big meetings at my Mar-a-Lago or at Trump Doral. It's just so blatant, and it's become, oh, I guess that's okay. It's not okay.
I can kind of see where Nancy Pelosi was going with that in the terms of that if you have 10 or 11 or 12 articles of impeachment, then you can give the not saying I necessarily agree with this strategy, Randy, but her idea was that then you give the Republicans the talking point of saying, oh, well, Democrats are just throwing everything they can at the wall and hoping something sticks. That's at least kind of the contention she was making.
Yeah, but that's kind of – okay. His own attorney is in prison for campaign violation, felony offense for what? Bribing – a porn star to keep her name out of the press before the election so that it wouldn't paint our lovely president in a bad light.
All right, Randy, we're going to have to leave it there since we are heading towards the end of the show. But as always, do appreciate the phone call at 952-946-6205. All right, so Governor Tim Walz, as I was saying, Eric, send him some good vibes because you know what he's doing today? He has to go on a two-hour school bus ride with several students down to Rochester. What he's doing is that today he's and members of the governor's cabinet are boarding a school bus to children's cabinet meeting in Rochester, where they're going to sit down with students, parents, and school district staff and community partners to talk about how to improve education. Now, I don't know if you have much experience doing this, but I do, as at least being a former high school coach. There is nothing worse than being on a school bus for several hours at one time. So I don't know what Governor Walz deserved that. Yeah. Well, it's different as a student, but there's nothing worse than actually being an adult and being stuck on a school bus. So, yeah, Governor Walz, send you some good vibes. Hope that school bus ride does not actually feel like 2 hours because that can sometimes be a little headache-inducing. All right, one more story today. So, obviously, the coronavirus has been in the news, but did you know 3M could be making a little bit of a profit off the coronavirus, as they have seen an increase in the number of production of face masks that they've been making? So, I guess if there's been one industry that has been benefiting from the coronavirus, it's Big Mask, maybe? I think Big Mask has got to be an industry, don't you?
I assume so.
Yeah, so either way, yeah, apparently they've been making a ton of these masks since the coronavirus has come into existence, selling those not in China, but also some orders in the U.S. as well. That's going to do it for FYI Politics with Brett Johnson. Again, hope to see you tonight over at Hamline University at 6 o'clock. More details at am950radio.com. Stay tuned. Matt McNeil is up next.